sense of private disquiet, only dispelled by abandoning herself to the joy and excitement of those around her. So many decent people could not be wrong, and doubts like hers, she's been told, are to be expected. Bryony did not wish to cancel the whole arrangement. She did not think she had the courage, after all her initial certainty and 2 or 3 days of patient, kindly interviewing, to withdraw her evidence. However, she would have preferred to qualify or complicate her use of the word saw. Less like seeing, more like knowing. Then she could have left it to her interrogators to decide whether they would proceed together in the name of this kind of vision. They were impassive whenever she wavered and firmly recalled her to her earliest statements. Was she a silly girl, their manner implied, who had wasted everybody's time? And they took an austere view of the visual. There was enough light, it was established, from stars and from the cloud base reflecting streetlights from the nearest town. Either she saw or she did not see. There lay nothing in between. They did not say as much, but their brusqueness implied it. It was in those moments, when she felt their coolness, that she reached back to revive her first ardour and said it again. I saw him. I know it was him. Then it was comforting to feel she was confirming what they already knew. She would never be able to console herself that she was pressured or bullied. She never was. She trapped herself, she marched into the labyrinth of her own construction, and was too young, too awestruck, too keen to please, to insist on making her own way back. She was not endowed with or old enough to possess such independence of spirit. An imposing congregation had massed itself around her first certainties, and now it was waiting, and she could not disappoint it at the altar. Her doubts could be neutralized only by plunging in deeper, by clinging tightly to what she believed she knew, narrowing her thoughts, reiterating her testimony. She was able to keep from mind the damage she only dimly sensed she was doing. When the matter was closed, when the sentence was passed and the congregation dispersed, a ruthless, youthful forgetting, a willful erasing, protected her well into her teens. Well, I can, and I will. They sat in silence for a while, and Lola's shivering began to subside. Bryony supposed she should get her cousin home, but she was reluctant to break this closeness for the moment. She had her arms around the older girl's shoulders, and she seemed to yield now to Bryony's touch. They saw far beyond the lake a bobbing pinprick of light, a torch being carried along the drive, but they did not comment on it. When at last Lola spoke, her tone was reflective, as though she were pondering subtle currents of counter-arguments.
But it doesn't make sense. He's such a close friend of your family. It might not have been him.
Bryony murmured, You wouldn't be saying that if you'd been with me in the library. Lola sighed and shook her head slowly, as though trying to reconcile herself to the unacceptable truth. They were silent again, and they might have sat longer had it not been for the damp, not quite yet dew, that was beginning to settle on the grass as the clouds cleared and the temperature dropped. When Bryony whispered to her cousin, "Do you think you can walk?" she nodded bravely. Bryony helped her to stand, and arm in arm at first, and then with Lola's weight on Bryony's shoulder, they made their way across the clearing toward the bridge. They reached the bottom of the slope, and it was here that Lola finally began to cry.
"I can't go up there," she had several attempts at saying. "I'm just too weak."
It would be better, Bryony decided, for her to run to the house and fetch help. And she was just about to explain this to Lola and settle her on the ground when they heard voices from the road above, and then torchlight was in their eyes. It was a miracle, Bryony thought, when she heard her brother's voice. Like the true hero he was, he came down the bank in several easy strides, and without even asking what the trouble was, took Lola into his arms and picked her up as though she were a small child. Cecilia was calling down in a voice that sounded hoarse with concern. No one answered her. Leon was already making his way up the incline at such a pace it was an effort to keep up with him. Even so, before they reached the driveway, before he had the chance to set Lola down, Bryony was beginning to tell him what had happened, exactly as she had seen it. Chapter 14. Her memories of the interrogation and signed statements and testimony, or of her awe outside the courtroom from which her youth excluded her, would not trouble her so much in the years to come as her fragmented recollection of that late night and summer dawn. How guilt refined the methods of self-torture, threading the beads of detail into an eternal loop, a rosary to be fingered for a lifetime. Back in the house at last, there began a dreamlike time of grave arrivals, tears and subdued voices and urgent footsteps across the hallway, and her own vile excitement that kept her drowsiness at bay. Of course, Bryony was old enough to know that the moment was entirely Lola's. But she was soon led away by sympathetic womanly hands to her bedroom to await the doctor and his examination. Bryony watched from the foot of the stairs as Lola ascended, sobbing loudly and flanked by Emily and Betty, and followed by Polly, who carried a basin and towels. Her cousin's removal left Bryony centre stage. There was no sign yet of Robbie, and the way she was listened to, deferred to, and gently prompted, seemed at one with her new maturity. It must have been about this time that a Humber stopped outside the house, and two police inspectors and two constables were shown in. Bryony was their only source, and she made herself speak calmly. Her vital role fueled her certainty. This was in the unstructured time before formal interviews, when she was standing facing the officers in the hallway, with Leon on one side of her and her mother on the other. But how had her mother materialized so quickly from Lola's bedside? The senior inspector had a heavy face, rich in seams, as though carved from folded granite. Bryony was fearful of him as she told her story to this watchful, unmoving mask. As she did so, she felt a weight lifting from her and a warm, submissive feeling spread from her stomach to her limbs. It was like love, a sudden love for this watchful man who stood unquestioningly for the cause of goodness, who came out at all hours to do battle in its name, and who was backed by all the human powers and wisdom that existed. Under his neutral gaze, her throat constricted and her voice began to buckle. She wanted the inspector to embrace her and comfort her and forgive her, however guiltless she was. But he would only look at her and listen. "It was him. I saw him." Her tears were further proof of the truth she felt and spoke, and when her mother's hand caressed her nape, she broke down completely and was led toward the drawing room. But if she was there being consoled by her mother on the Chesterfield, how did she come to remember the arrival of Dr. McLaren in his black waistcoat and his old-fashioned raised shirt collar, carrying the Gladstone bag that had been witness to the three births and all the childhood illnesses of the Tallis household? Leon conferred with the doctor, leaning toward him to murmur a manly summary of events. Where was Leon's carefree lightness now? This quiet consultation was typical of the hours to come. Each fresh arrival was briefed in this way. People, police, doctor, family members, servants, stood in knots that unravelled and reformed in corners of rooms, the hallway, and the terrace outside the French windows. Nothing was brought together or formulated in public. Everyone knew the terrible facts of a violation, but it remained everyone's secret, shared in whispers among shifting groups that broke away self-importantly to new business. Even more serious, potentially, was the matter of the missing children. But the general view, constantly reiterated like a magic spell, was that they were safely asleep somewhere in the park. In this way, attention remained mostly fixed on the plight of the girl upstairs. Paul Marshall came in from searching and learned the news from the inspectors. He walked up and down the terrace with them, one on each side, and on the turn offered them cigarettes from a gold case. When their conversation was over, he patted the senior man on the shoulder and seemed to send them on their way. Then he came inside to confer with Emily Tallis. Leon led the doctor upstairs, who descended some while later, intangibly enlarged by his professional encounter with the core of all their concerns. He too stood in lengthy conference with the two plainclothesmen, and then with Leon, and finally with Leon and Mrs. Tallis. Not long before his departure, the doctor came and placed his familiar small dry hand on Bryony's forehead, fingered her pulse, and was satisfied. He took up his bag, but before he was gone, there was a final muttered interview by the front door. Where was Cecilia? She hovered on the peripheries, speaking to no one, always smoking, raising the cigarette to her lips with a rapid, hungry movement and pulling it away in agitated disgust. At other times, she twisted a handkerchief in her hand as she paced the hallway. Normally, she would have taken control of a situation like this, directing the care of Lola, reassuring her mother, listening to the doctor's advice, consulting with Leon. Bryony was close by when her brother came over to talk to Cecilia, who turned away, unable to help or even speak. As for their mother, untypically she rose to the crisis, free of migraine and the need to be alone. She actually grew as her older daughter shrank into private misery. There were times when Bryony, called on again to give her account or some detail of it, saw her sister approach within earshot and look on with a smouldering, impenetrable gaze. Bryony became nervous of her and kept close to her mother's side. Cecilia's eyes were bloodshot. While others stood murmuring in groups, she moved restlessly up and down the room, or from one room to another, or, on at least two occasions, went to stand outside the front door. Nervously, she transferred the hanky from one hand to the other, coiled it between her fingers, unwound it, squeezed it in a ball, took it in the other hand, lit another cigarette. When Betty and Polly brought round tea, Cecilia would not touch it. Word came down that Lola, sedated by the doctor, was at last asleep, and the news provided temporary relief. Unusually, everyone had gathered in the drawing room where tea was taken in exhausted silence. Nobody said it, but they were waiting for Robbie. Also, Mr. Tallis was expected from London at any moment. Leon and Marshall were leaning over a map they were drawing of the grounds for the inspector's benefit. He took it, studied it, and passed it to his assistant. The two constables had been sent out to join those looking for Piero and Jackson, and more policemen were supposed to be on their way down to the bungalow in case Robbie had gone there. Like Marshall, Cecilia sat apart on the harpsichord stool. At one point, she rose to get a light from her brother, but it was the chief inspector who obliged her with his own lighter. Bryony was next to her mother on the sofa, and Betty and Polly took round the tray. Bryony was to have no memory of what suddenly prompted her. An idea of great clarity and persuasiveness came from nowhere, and she did not need to announce her intentions or ask her sister's permission. Clinching evidence, cleanly independent of her own version. Verification, or even another separate crime. She startled the room with her gasp of inspiration and almost knocked her mother's tea from her lap as she stood. They all watched as she hurried from the room, but no one questioned her, such was the general fatigue. She, on the other hand, was taking the stairs two at a time, energized now by a sense of doing and being good, on the point of springing a surprise that could only earn her praise. It was rather like that Christmas morning sensation of being about to give a present that was bound to cause delight, a joyful feeling of blameless self-love. She ran along the second-floor corridor to Cecilia's room. What squalor and disorder her sister lived in! Both wardrobe doors hung wide open. Various dresses were skewed out of their rows, and some were half off their hangers. On the floor, two dresses, one black, one pink, silky, expensive-looking things, lay in a tangle, and round this pile lay kicked-off shoes on their sides. Bryony stepped over and around the mess to get to the dressing table. What was the impulse that prevented Cecilia from replacing the caps and lids and screw-tops of her makeup and perfumes? Why did she never empty her stinking ashtray, or make her bed, or open a window to let in the fresh air? The first drawer she tried opened only a couple of inches. It was jammed, crammed full of bottles and a cardboard package. Cecilia might have been 10 years older, but there really was something quite hopeless and helpless about her. Even though Bryony was fearful of the wild look her sister had downstairs, it was right, the younger girl thought as she pulled open another drawer, that she was there for her, thinking clearly on her behalf. 5 minutes later, when she re-entered the drawing room in triumph, no one paid her any attention, and everything was exactly the same. Tired, miserable adults, sipping tea and smoking in silence. In her excitement, she had not considered who it was she should give the letter to. A trick of her imagination had everyone reading it at once. She decided Leon should have it. She crossed the room toward her brother, but when she arrived in front of the three men, she changed her mind and put the folded sheet of paper into the hands of the policeman with the face of granite. If he had an expression, it did not change as he took the letter, nor when he read it, which he did at great speed, almost at a glance. His eyes met hers, then shifted to take in Cecilia, who was facing away. With the slightest movement of his wrist, he indicated that the other policeman should take the letter. When he was finished, it was passed on to Leon, who read it, folded it, and returned it to the senior inspector. Bryony was impressed by the muted response. Such was the three men's worldliness. It was only now that Emily Tallis became aware of the focus of their interest. In answer to her unemphatic query, Leon said, "It's just a letter. I'll read it." For the second time that evening, Emily was obliged to assert her rights over written messages passing through her household. Feeling that nothing more was required of her, Bryony went to sit on the Chesterfield and watched from her mother's perspective the chivalrous unease that shifted between Leon and the policeman. "I'll read it." Ominously, she did not vary her tone. Leon shrugged and forced an apologetic smile. What possible objection could he have? And Emily's mild gaze settled on the two inspectors. She belonged to a generation that treated policemen as menials, whatever their rank. Obedient to the nod from his superior, the young inspector crossed the room and presented the letter to her. At last, Cecilia, who must have been a long way off in her thoughts, was taking an interest. Then the letter lay exposed on her mother's lap, and Cecilia was on her feet, then moving toward them from the harpsichord stool. "How dare you! How dare you all!" Leon stood too, and made a calming gesture with his palms. "See?" When she made a lunge to snatch the letter from her mother, she found not only her brother but the two policemen in her way. Marshall was standing too, but not interfering. "It belongs to me," she shouted. "You have absolutely no right." Emily did not even look up from her reading, and she gave herself time to read the letter several times over. When she was done, she met her daughter's fury with her own colder version. "If you had done the right thing, young lady, with all your education, and come to me with this, then something could have been done in time, and your cousin would have been spared her nightmare." For a moment, Cecilia stood alone in the centre of the room, fluttering the fingers of her right hand, staring at them each in turn, unable to believe her association with such people, unable to begin to tell them what she knew. And though Bryony felt vindicated by the reaction of the adults and was experiencing the onset of a sweet and inward rapture, she was also pleased to be down on the sofa with her mother, partially screened by the standing men from her sister's red-eyed contempt. She held them in its grip for several seconds before she turned and walked out of the room. As she went across the hallway, she gave out a cry of sheer vexation, which was amplified by the raw acoustic of the bare floor tiles. In the drawing room, there was a sense of relief, of relaxation almost, as they heard her go up the stairs. When Bryony next remembered to look, the letter was in Marshall's hands, and he was passing it back to the inspector, who placed it unfolded into a binder which the younger policeman was holding open for him. The hours of the night spun away from her, and she remained untired. It occurred to no one to send her to her bed. Some immeasurable time after Cecilia had gone to her room, Bryony went with her mother to the library to have the first of her formal interviews with the police. Mrs. Tallis remained standing, while Bryony sat on one side of the writing desk and the inspectors sat on the other. The one with the face of ancient rock, who was the one who asked the questions, turned out to be infinitely kind, speaking his unhurried questions in a gruff voice that was both gentle and sad. Since she was able to show them the precise location of Robbie's attack on Cecilia, they all wandered into that corner of the bookshelves to take a closer look. Bryony wedged herself in, with her back to the books, to show them how her sister was positioned, and saw the first mid-blue touches of dawn in the panes of the library's high windows. She stepped out and turned around to demonstrate the attacker's stance and showed where she herself had stood. Emily said, "But why didn't you tell me?" The policeman looked at Bryony and waited. It was a good question, but it would never have occurred to her to trouble her mother. Nothing but a migraine would have come of it. "We were called into dinner, then the twins ran off." She explained how she came by the letter on the bridge at dusk. What led her to open it? Difficult to describe the impulsive moment when she had not permitted herself to think of the consequences before acting, or how the writer she had only that day become needed to know to understand everything that came her way. She said, "I don't know. I was being horribly nosy. I hated myself." It was about this time that a constable put his head round the door to give news that seemed at one with the calamity of the night. Mr. Tallis's driver had rung from a phone box near Croydon Airport. The departmental car, made available at short notice through the kindness of the minister, had broken down in the suburbs. Jack Tallis was asleep under a rug on the back seat and would probably have to continue by the first morning train. Once these facts had been absorbed and lamented, Bryony was gently returned to the scene itself, to the events on the Lake Island. At this early stage, the inspector was careful not to oppress the young girl with probing questions, and within this sensitively created space, she was able to build and shape her narrative in her own words and establish the key facts. There was just sufficient light for her to recognize a familiar face. When he shrank away from her and circled the clearing, his movements and height were familiar to her as well.
"You saw him then?"
"I know it was him."
"Let's forget what you know. You're saying you saw him?"
"Yes, I saw him."
"Just as you see me?"
"Yes."
"You saw him with your own eyes?"
"Yes, I saw him, I saw him."
Thus her first formal interview concluded.
while she sat in the drawing-room, feeling her tiredness at last, but unwilling to go to bed, her mother was questioned, then Leon and Paul Marshall. Old Hardman and his son Danny were brought in for interview. Bryony heard Betty say that Danny was at home all evening with his father, who was able to vouch for him. Various constables came to the front door from searching for the twins and were shown through to the kitchen. In the confused and unmemorable time of that early dawn, Bryony gathered that Cecilia was refusing to leave her room, refusing to come down to be interviewed. In the days to come, she would be given no choice, and when she finally yielded up her own account of what happened in the library, in its way, far more shocking than Bryony's, however consensual the encounter had been, it merely confirmed the general view that had formed. Mr. Turner was a dangerous man. Cecilia's repeated suggestion that it was Danny Hardman they should be talking to was heard in silence. It was understandable, though poor form, that this young woman should be covering for her friend by casting suspicion on an innocent boy. Sometime after 5, when there was talk of breakfast being prepared, at least for the constables, for no one else was hungry, the word flashed through the household that a figure who might be Robbie was approaching across the park. Perhaps someone had been watching from an upstairs window. Bryony did not know how the decision was made that they should all go outside to wait for him. Suddenly they were all there, family, Paul Marshall, Betty and her helpers, the policeman, a reception party grouped tightly around the front entrance. Only Lola in a drugged coma and Cecilia with her fury remained upstairs. It might have been that Mrs. Tallis did not want the polluting presence to step inside her house. The inspector may have feared violence, which was more easily dealt with outdoors, where there was more space to make an arrest. All the magic of dawn had gone now, and in its place was a grey early morning, distinguished only by a summer's mist, which was sure to burn off soon. At first they saw nothing, though Bryony thought she could make out the tread of shoes along the drive. Then everyone could hear it, and there was a collective murmur and shifting of weight as they caught sight of an indefinable shape, no more than a greyish smudge against the white, almost 100 yards away. As the shape took form, the waiting group fell silent again. No one could quite believe what was emerging. Surely it was a trick of the mist and light. No one in this age of telephones and motor cars could believe that giants 7 or 8 feet high existed in crowded Surrey. But here it was, an apparition as inhuman as it was purposeful. The thing was impossible and undeniable and heading their way. Betty, who was known to be a Catholic, crossed herself as the little crowd huddled closer to the entrance. Only the senior inspector took a couple of paces forward, and as he did so, everything became clear. The clue was a second tiny shape that bobbed alongside the first. Then it was obvious. This was Robbie with one boy sitting up on his shoulders and the other holding his hand and trailing a little behind. When he was less than 30 feet away, Robbie stopped and seemed about to speak, but waited instead as the inspector and the other policeman approached. The boy on his shoulders appeared to be asleep. The other boy let his head loll against Robbie's waist and drew the man's hand across his chest for protection or warmth. Bryony's immediate feeling was one of relief that the boys were safe. But as she looked at Robbie waiting calmly, she experienced a flash of outrage. Did he believe he could conceal his crime behind an apparent kindness, behind the show of being the good shepherd? This was surely a cynical attempt to win forgiveness for what could never be forgiven.
She was confirmed again in her view that evil was complicated and misleading. Suddenly her mother's hands were pressing firmly on her shoulders and turning her toward the house, delivering her into Betty's care. Emily wanted her daughter well away from Robbie Turner. It was bedtime at last. Betty took a firm grip of her hand and was leading her in as her mother and brother went forward to collect the twins. Bryony's last glimpse back over her shoulder as she was pulled away showed her Robbie raising two hands as though in surrender. He lifted the boy clear of his head and placed him gently on the ground. An hour later, she was lying on her canopy bed in the clean white cotton nightdress which Betty had found for her. The curtains were drawn, but the daylight gleam around their edges was strong, and for all her spinning sensations of tiredness, she could not sleep. Voices and images were ranged around her bedside, agitated, nagging presences, jostling and merging, resisting her attempts to set them in order. Were they all really bounded by a single day, by one period of unbroken wakefulness, from the innocent rehearsals of her play to the emergence of the giant from the mist? All that lay between was too clamorous, too fluid to understand, though she sensed she had succeeded, even triumphed. She kicked the sheet clear of her legs and turned the pillow to find a cooler patch for her cheeks. In her dizzy state, she was not able to say exactly what her success had been. If it was to have gained a new maturity, she could hardly feel it now when she was so helpless, so childish even through lack of sleep, to the point where she thought she could easily make herself cry. If it was brave to have identified a thoroughly bad person, then it was wrong of him to turn up with the twins like that, and she felt cheated. Who would believe her now with Robbie posing as the kindly rescuer of lost children? All her work, all her courage and clear-headedness, all she had done to bring Lola home, for nothing. They would turn their backs on her, her mother, the policeman, her brother, and go off with Robbie Turner to indulge some adult cabal. She wanted her mother. She wanted to put her arms round her mother's neck and pull her lovely face close to hers. But her mother wouldn't come now. No one would come to Bryony. No one would talk to her now. She turned her face into the pillow and let her tears drain into it, and felt that yet more was lost, when there was no witness to her sorrow. She had been lying in the semi-darkness, nursing this palatable sadness for half an hour, when she heard the sound of the police car parked below her window starting up. It rolled across the gravel, then stopped. There were voices and the crunch of several footsteps. She got up and parted the curtains. The mist was still there, but it was brighter, as though illuminated from within, and she half closed her eyes while they adjusted to the glare. All four doors of the police Humber were wide open, and three constables were waiting by it. The voices came from a group directly below her by the front door, just out of sight. Then came the sound of footsteps again, and they emerged, the two inspectors, with Robbie between them. And handcuffed. She saw how his arms were forced in front of him, and from her vantage point she saw the silver glint of steel below his shirt cuff. The disgrace of it horrified her. It was further confirmation of his guilt and the beginning of his punishment. It had the look of eternal damnation. They reached the car and stopped. Robbie half turned, but she could not read his expression. He stood erect, several inches higher than the inspector, with his head lifted up. Perhaps he was proud of what he had done. One of the constables got in the driver's seat. The junior inspector was walking round to the rear door on the far side, and his chief was about to guide Robbie into the back seat. There was the sound of a commotion directly below Bryony's window, and of Emily Tallis's voice calling sharply, and suddenly a figure was running toward the car as fast as was possible in a tight dress. Cecilia slowed as she approached. Robbie turned and took half a pace toward her, and, surprisingly, the inspector stepped back. The handcuffs were in full view, but Robbie did not appear ashamed or even aware of them as he faced Cecilia and listened gravely to what she was saying. The impassive policeman looked on. If she was delivering the bitter indictment Robbie deserved to hear, it did not show on his face. Though Cecilia was facing away from her, Bryony thought she was speaking with very little animation. Her accusations would be all the more powerful for being muttered. They had moved closer, and now Robbie spoke briefly, and half raised his locked hands and let them fall. She touched them with her own and fingered his lapel, and then gripped it and shook it gently. It seemed a kindly gesture, and Bryony was touched by her sister's capacity for forgiveness, if this was what it was. Forgiveness. The word had never meant a thing before, though Bryony had heard it exalted at 1,000 school and church occasions. And all the time, her sister had understood. There was, of course, much that she did not know about Cecilia. But there would be time, for this tragedy was bound to bring them closer. The kindly inspector with the granite face must have thought he had been indulgent enough, for he stepped forward to brush away Cecilia's hand and interpose himself. Robbie said something to her quickly over the officer's shoulder and turned toward the car. Considerately, the inspector raised his own hand to Robbie's head and pressed down hard on it, so that he did not bang it as he stooped to climb into the back seat. The two inspectors wedged themselves on each side of their prisoner. The doors slammed, and the one constable, left behind, touched his helmet in salute as the car moved forward. Cecilia remained where she was, facing down the drive, tranquilly watching the car as it receded, but the tremors along the line of her shoulders confided she was crying, and Bryony knew she had never loved her sister more than now. It should have ended there, this seamless day that had wrapped itself around a summer's night. It should have concluded then with the Humber disappearing down the drive. But there remained a final confrontation. The car had gone no more than 20 yards when it began to slow. A figure Bryony had not noticed was coming down the centre of the drive and showed no intention of standing to one side. It was a woman, rather short, with a rolling walk, wearing a floral print dress and gripping what looked at first like a stick, but was in fact a man's umbrella with a goose's head. The car stopped, and the horn sounded as the woman came up and stood right against the radiator grille. It was Robbie's mother, Grace Turner. She raised the umbrella and shouted. The policeman in the front passenger seat had got out and was speaking to her, and then took her by the elbow. The other constable, the one who had saluted, was hurrying over. Mrs. Turner shook her arm free, raised the umbrella again, this time with two hands, and brought it down, goose head first, with a crack like a pistol shot, onto the Humber's shiny bonnet. As the constables half pushed, half carried her to the edge of the drive, she began to shout a single word so loudly that Bryony could hear it from her bedroom.
"Liars! Liars! Liars!"
Mrs. Turner roared. With its front door wide open, the car moved past her slowly and stopped to let the policeman get back in. On his own, his colleague was having difficulty restraining her. She managed another swipe with her umbrella, but the blow glanced off the car's roof. He wrestled the umbrella from her and tossed it over his shoulder onto the grass.
"Liars! Liars!"
Grace Turner shouted again and took a few hopeless steps after the retreating car and then stopped
hands on hips, to watch as it went over the first bridge, crossed the island, and then the second bridge, and finally vanished into the whiteness.
This ends Disc 6. Atonement, Disc 7.
Part 2. There were horrors enough, but it was the unexpected detail that threw him, and afterward would not let him go. When they reached the level crossing after a 3-mile walk along a narrow road, he saw the path he was looking for meandering off to the right, then dipping and rising toward a copse that covered a low hill to the northwest. They stopped so that he could consult the map. But it wasn't where he thought it should be. It wasn't in his pocket or tucked into his belt. Had he dropped it, or put it down at the last stop? He let his greatcoat fall on the ground and was reaching inside his jacket when he realized. The map was in his left hand and must have been there for over an hour. He glanced across at the other two, but they were facing away from him, standing apart, smoking silently. It was still in his hand. He had prized it from the fingers of a captain in the West Kents, lying in a ditch outside. Outside where? These rear area maps were rare. He also took the dead captain's revolver. He wasn't trying to impersonate an officer. He had lost his rifle and simply intended to survive. The path he was interested in started down the side of a bombed house, fairly new, perhaps a railwayman's cottage rebuilt after the last time. There were animal tracks in the mud surrounding a puddle in a tire rut. Probably goats. Scattered around were shreds of striped cloth with blackened edges, remains of curtains or clothing, and a smashed-in window frame draped across a bush, and everywhere the smell of damp soot. This was their path, their shortcut. He folded the map away, and as he straightened from picking up the coat and was slinging it around his shoulders, he saw it. The others, sensing his movement, turned round and followed his gaze. It was a leg in a tree. A mature plane tree, only just in leaf. The leg was 20 feet up, wedged in the first forking of the trunk, bare, severed cleanly above the knee. From where they stood, there was no sign of blood or torn flesh. It was a perfect leg, pale, smooth, small enough to be a child's. The way it was angled in the fork, it seemed to be on display for their benefit or enlightenment. This is a leg. The two corporals made a dismissive sound of disgust and picked up their stuff. They refused to be drawn in. In the past few days, they had seen enough. Nettle, the lorry driver, took out another cigarette and said, "So, which way, Governor?" They called him that to settle the difficult matter of rank. He set off down the path in a hurry, almost at a half run. He wanted to get ahead, out of sight, so that he could throw up or crap, he didn't know which. Behind a barn, by a pile of broken slates, his body chose the first option for him. He was so thirsty, he couldn't afford to lose the fluid. He drank from his canteen and walked around the barn. He made use of this moment alone to look at his wound. It was on his right side, just below his rib cage, about the size of a half crown. It wasn't looking so bad after he washed away the dried blood yesterday. Though the skin around it was red, there wasn't much swelling. But there was something in there. He could feel it move when he walked. A piece of shrapnel, perhaps. By the time the corporals caught up, he had tucked his shirt back in and was pretending to study the map. In their company, the map was his only privacy.
"What's the hurry?"
"He's seen some crumpet."
"It's the map. He's having his fucking doubts again."
No doubts, gentlemen. This is our path. He took out a cigarette, and Corporal Mace lit it for him. Then, to conceal the trembling in his hands, Robbie Turner walked on, and they followed him as they had followed him for 2 days now. Or was it three? He was lower in rank, but they followed and did everything he suggested, and to preserve their dignity, they teased him. When they tramped the roads or cut across the fields and he was silent for too long, Mace would say,
"Governor, you thinking about Crumpet again?"
And Nettle would chant,
"He fucking is! He fucking is!"
They were townies who disliked the countryside and were lost in it. The compass points meant nothing to them. That part of basic training had passed them by. They had decided that to reach the coast, they needed him. It was difficult for them. He acted like an officer, but he didn't even have a single stripe. On the first night, when they were sheltering in the bike shed of a burned-out school, Corporal Nettle said,
"What's a private soldier like you doing, talking like a toff?"
He didn't owe them explanations. He intended to survive. He had one good reason to survive, and he didn't care whether they tagged along or not. Both men had hung on to their rifles. That was something, at least. And Mace was a big man, strong across the shoulders, and with hands that could have spanned 1.5 octaves of the pub piano he said he played. Nor did Turner mind about the taunts. All he wanted now, as they followed the path away from the road, was to forget about the leg. Their path joined a track which ran between two stone walls and dropped down into a valley that had not been visible from the road. At the bottom was a brown stream which they crossed on stepping stones set deep in a carpet of what looked like miniature water parsley. Their route swung to the west as they rose out of the valley, still between the ancient walls. Ahead of them, the sky was beginning to clear a little and glowed like a promise. Everywhere else was grey. As they approached the top through a copse of chestnut trees, the lowering sun dropped below the cloud cover and caught the scene, dazzling the three soldiers as they rose into it. How fine it might have been to end a day's ramble in the French countryside, walking into the setting sun. Always a hopeful act. As they came out of the copse, they heard bombers, so they went back in and smoked while they waited under the trees. From where they were, they could not see the plains, but the view was fine. These were hardly hills that spread so expansively before them. They were ripples in the landscape, faint echoes of vast upheavals elsewhere. Each successive ridge was paler than the one before. He saw a receding wash of grey and blue fading in a haze toward the setting sun, like something oriental on a dinner plate. Half an hour later, they were making a long traverse across a deeper slope that edged further to the north and delivered them at last to another valley, another little stream. This one had a more confident flow, and they crossed it by a stone bridge thick with cow dung. The corporals, who were not as tired as he was, had a lark pretending to be revolted. One of them threw a dried lump of dung at his back. Turner did not look round. The scraps of cloth, he was beginning to think, may have been a child's pyjamas. A boy's. The dive bombers, sometimes, came over not long after dawn. He was trying to push it away, but it would not let him go. A French boy asleep in his bed. Turner wanted to put more distance between himself and that bombed cottage. It was not only the German army and air force pursuing him now. If there had been a moon, he would have been happy walking all night. The corporals wouldn't like it. Perhaps it was time to shake them off. Downstream of the bridge was a line of poplars, whose tops fluttered brilliantly in the last of the light. The soldiers turned in the other direction, and soon the track was a path again and was leaving the stream. They wound and squeezed their way through bushes with fat, shiny leaves. There were also stunted oaks, barely in leaf. The vegetation underfoot smelled sweet and damp, and he thought there must be something wrong with the place to make it so different from anything they had seen. Ahead of them was the hum of machinery. It grew louder, angrier, and suggested the high-velocity spin of flywheels or electric turbines turning at impossible speed. They were entering a great hall of sound and power. "Bees!" he called out. He had to turn and say it again before they heard him. The air was already darker. He knew the law well enough. If one stuck in your hair and stung you, it sent out a chemical message as it died, and all who received it were compelled to come and sting and die at the same place. General conscription. After all the danger, this was a kind of insult. They lifted their great coats over their heads and ran on through the swarm. Still among the bees, they reached a stinking ditch of slurry, which they crossed by a wobbling plank. They came up behind a barn where it was suddenly peaceful. Beyond it was a farmyard. As soon as they were in it, dogs were barking, and an old woman was running toward them, flapping her hands at them, as though they were hens she could shoo away. The corporals depended on Turner's French. He went forward and waited for her to reach him. There were stories of civilians selling bottles of water for 10 francs, but he had never seen it. The French he had met were generous, or otherwise lost to their own miseries. The woman was frail and energetic. She had a gnarled, man-in-the-moon face and a wild look. Her voice was sharp.
C'est impossible, monsieur. Vous ne pouvez pas rester ici?
We'll stay in the barn. We need water, wine, bread, cheese, and anything else you can spare.
Impossible,
he said to her softly. We've been fighting for France.
You can't stay here.
We'll be gone at dawn. The Germans are still...
It's not the Germans, monsieur, it's my sons. They are animals, and they'll be back soon.
Turner pushed past the woman and went to the pump, which was in the corner of the yard near the kitchen. Nettle and Mace followed him. While he drank, a girl of about 10 and an infant brother holding her hand watched him from the doorway. When he finished and had filled his canteen, he smiled at them and they fled. The corporals were under the pump together, drinking simultaneously. The woman was suddenly behind him, clutching at his elbow. Before she could start again, he said, "Please bring us what I asked for, or we'll come in and get it for ourselves."
"My sons are brutes. They'll kill me."
He would have preferred to say, "So be it," but instead he walked away and called over his shoulder, "I'll talk to them."
"And then, monsieur, they would kill you. They will tear you to shreds."
Corporal Mace was a cook in the same RASC unit as Corporal Nettle. Before he joined, he was a warehouseman at Heels in the Tottenham Court Road. He said he knew a thing or two about comfort, and in the barn he set about arranging their quarters. Turner would have thrown himself down on the straw. Mace found a heap of sacks, and with Nettle's help, stuffed them to make up 3 mattresses. He made headboards out of hay bales, which he lifted down with a single hand. He set up a door on brick piles for a table. He took out 1/2 candle from his pocket.
"Might as well be comfy," he kept saying under his breath.
It was the first time they had moved much beyond sexual innuendo. The 3 men lay on their beds, smoking and waiting. Now they were no longer thirsty. Their thoughts were on the food they were about to get, and they heard each other's stomachs rumbling and squirting in the gloom, and it made them laugh. Turner told them about his conversation with the old woman and what she had said about her sons.
"Fifth columnists they would be," Nettle said.
He only looked small alongside his friend, but he had a small man's sharp features and a friendly rodent look, heightened by his way of resting the teeth of his upper jaw on his lower lip.
"Or French Nazis, German sympathisers, like we got Mosley," Mace said.
They were silent for a while, then Mace added,
"Or like they all are in the country, bonkers from marrying too close."
"Whatever it is," Turner said, "I think you should check your weapons now and have them handy." They did as they were told. Mace lit the candle, and they went through the routines. Turner checked his pistol and put it within reach. When the corporals were finished, they propped the Lee Enfields against a wooden crate and lay down on their beds again. Presently, the girl came with a basket. She set it down by the barn door and ran away. Nettle fetched the basket, and they spread out what they had on their table. A round loaf of brown bread, a small piece of soft cheese, an onion and a bottle of wine. The bread was hard to cut and tasted of mould. The cheese was good, but it was gone in seconds. They passed the bottle around, and soon that was gone too. So they chewed on the musty bread and ate the onion. Nettle said,
"I wouldn't give this to my fucking dog."
"I'll go across," Turner said, "and get something better."
"We'll come too."
But for a while, they lay back on their beds in silence. No one felt like confronting the old lady just yet. Then, at the sound of footsteps, they turned and saw two men standing in the entrance. They each held something in their hands, a club, perhaps, or a shotgun. In the fading light, it was not possible to tell, nor could they see the faces of the French brothers. The voice was soft.
"Bonsoir, messieurs. Bonsoir."
As Turner got up from his straw bed, he took the revolver. The corporals reached for their rifles.
"Go easy," he whispered.
"Anglais? Belge?"
"Anglais."
"We have something for you."
"What sort of thing?"
"What's he saying?"
one of the corporals said.
"He says they've got something for us."
"Fucking hell!"
The men came a couple of steps closer and raised what was in their hands. Shotguns, surely. Turner released his safety catch. He heard Mace and Nettle do the same.
"Easy," he murmured.
"Put away your guns, monsieur."
"Put away yours."
"Wait a little moment."
The figure who spoke was reaching into his pocket. He brought out a torch and shone it not at the soldiers, but at his brother, at what was in his hand. A French loaf. And at what was in the other hand, a canvas bag. Then he showed them the two baguettes he himself was holding.
"And we have olives, cheese, pâté, tomatoes and ham. And naturally wine. Vive l'Angleterre."
"Vive la France."
They sat at Mace's table, which the Frenchmen, Henri and Jean-Marie Bonnet, politely admired, along with the mattresses. They were short, stocky men in their 50s. Henri wore glasses, which Nettle said looked odd on a farmer. Turner did not translate. As well as wine, they brought glass tumblers. The five men raised them in toasts to the French and British armies and to the crushing of Germany. The brothers watched the soldiers eat. Through Turner, May said that he had never tasted, never even heard of goose liver pâté,
and from now on he would eat nothing else. The Frenchman smiled, but their manner was constrained, and they seemed in no mood to get drunk. They said they had driven all the way to a hamlet near Arras in their flatbed farm truck to look for a young cousin and her children. A great battle had been fought for the town, but they had no idea